I actually have no question. I was waving to Bob. Rise of Four, is it ever going to eventuate?
I guess you guys ought to have your own mic. We do have two. So we should probably. So one of my former colleagues just pointed out that we need to introduce. Yes.
Hi, I'm Matthew Garris. I know nothing about file systems.
And what's your favourite colour?
Blue.
You sure it's not red?
Yes. I'm Dave Jones. I maintain the Fedora kernel, and I don't really know anything about file systems either.
I'm Dave Early, and I do kernel graphics work and Xorg work, and I know even less about file systems than the previous two.
Well, I'm Ben Herrenschmidt. I do all sorts of things, mostly PowerPC related, and I don't have the beginning of a clue about file systems.
My name is Dave Miller, and as you saw, I do networking. I don't have enough work to do, so perhaps I should get into file systems someday.
Do we have anyone in the room who's ever worked on a file system in their life? What do you think about Riser FS and Riser 4?
No comment.
Apparently, this is a very political question. Yeah, actually, that was really funny. Did everyone here get that email? That was awesome. I think this guy spammed everyone who's ever been listed in the maintainers or has ever posted to Linux kernel, telling us how we were all part of this great big conspiracy, and we've actually framed Hans Reiser. No kidding, that's what it says in this email.
Mike.
How much of the email ever did you read? Who actually read the whole thing?
I read like the first three paragraphs and sent him a fairly stinging reply and left it at that. Is it on?
Hello.
That hardware, it's always broken.
That sounds better. Oh, so anyways, I'll answer the Riser 4 question generically. You may not like that, but that's tough. So, any time, just like with anything else big that wants to go into the kernel, there's a lot of resistance even when there is someone passionate about the technology and can put a lot of effort into merging it in and convincing people that it's a good idea. With what's going on there, that is no longer the case. It's not getting pushed actively, so you know the chances are slim to nil unless someone steps up and picks up the ball and you know does all the hard work of getting it merged. It's just as simple as it gets.
Thanks, Dave. Next question.
My question, I'm a system administrator. I tend to build a fair number of systems. Something I stumble across occasionally is the problem of loading or not loading modules at boot time. Is there going to be a solution to this, do you think? As in being able to tell, for me it's mostly right at the actual, before you get to modules.conf, I'm trying to kickstart a system, and there's one way of doing it. I can pull apart the initrd file and remove the module physically, but that's a bit of a pain. So I would like to be able to say at grub, don't load this module because this module actually corrupts my file system, or loads up drivers it loads up the RAID array when I don't want it to do that. So yeah, is there a good way of doing that? Because I don't think there is at the moment.
Okay, so it's a user space problem. More usefully, really, this is the kernel doesn't really know, for instance, that you have a RAID set up. That's something that's going to be handled by, all the kernel will do at this point is send out an event or provide information saying that there is something with this PCI ID. User space is then taking that PCI ID and using that to load a module. So attempting to do anything with that would probably involve, at the kernel level, would probably involve putting a lot of policy in the kernel. But it would be very straightforward to add support for, say, UDEV to, when it would be loading modules, check that the kernel command line that was passed and say, OK, I'm not going to load this module because I was passed a parameter that tells me that this module is backlisted. And that would probably be a perfectly valid feature request for any distribution. The main problem here is that most distributions have completely independent ways of generating their MFSs. So it's not something that can be fixed particularly centrally in one go, I suspect.
And then there's UDEV, but we all know it's all Greg's fault.
Yeah, a lot of the init RAMFSs in certain distributions have a lot of legacy that we're not quite sure how certain things work anymore, as in the person who wrote it may have moved on. So when we try to redo those things using a new system that would work properly in most situations, we find out on some enterprise system that we don't like that we no longer work. So it's one of these, there's a lot of sort of invested bug fixing in the init RAMFS and moving distros away from this history towards something more modern or more useful. That's why everyone has their own one and everyone sort of sticks to it, because it's a scary area, and if it breaks bad, people's machines stop booting. So it's kind of a hard area to mess around though. I could name four of them with all bad ones. Maybe the one I work on.
It's sometimes a bit tricky because in some areas, for example, take a legacy ISA stuff, Perl ports, serial ports, that sort of thing. In many cases, the only way to know whether it's there is to actually load the driver, poke at the hardware, and see if anything responds, especially on x86. It's getting better. There are ways nowadays to eventually have the firmware, if it's not completely broken, to tell you what's there. But often, it's still the case that those init RAMFS will just load all those things. Just in case you have the hardware, and they're going to pick and poke at things, and sometimes it can be deadly. Unfortunately, you have to just pray for firmware to get better or get a same firmware architecture.
And the corollary is also true. It would probably be useful for a lot of people because they're like, okay, this one PCI device I have in this bus, every time it loads the driver, it eats my machine up. Well, if you know the PCI geographic location, we could add a command line option that says don't allow any driver to register for this PCI device, or in fact hide it from the PCI device tree so that no driver can try to actually execute it. In fact, a lot of machines have this capability in the firmware already. So example, on Spark 64, you can set a variable under the PCI bus that says ignore these slots, and they don't even show up at all in the system.
Sorry, did you just say a lot of machines and then Spark 64?
By CPU count, not by system count.
As a partial response to that previous question, is there any possibility of adding whiteout support for init RAMFS?
Whiteout, like erase things from the
Lots of people are hearing whiteout. What's whiteout? Whiteout is mostly used for things like union FSs, where you've deleted something and you don't, and you want to make it appear to have disappeared, but it hasn't actually disappeared.
I think that's a file system question.
Init RAM FS.
So this is probably for you, Dave. So I used to work on InfiniBand stuff, and I'm familiar with RDMA a little bit.
Which one?
InfiniBand.
Yeah.
Once upon a time, Roland Dreyer's favorite thing. Yeah, exactly. So the thing about RDMA that's interesting is that it provides opportunity for much better cache locality on the application side, for interconnect to be able to applications to talk to other applications in a cluster. And you can have that cache locality, and it works actually very well compared to a normal NIC where you were already talking about, you know, events coming in on one place where the application is running on a different one, and then you have other goo in the middle, NetFilter or something else that prevents, that interferes with the cache usage. Is there anything else that you can envision besides RDMA or improve
Intel
RDMA?
Intel has IOAT DMA, and you can just imagine that that kind of technology is going to become pervasive into other areas as well. Another example is that, I should have brought this up. So Herbert Zhu did a lot of interesting work in the crypto layers in our IPsec stack to make it finally support asynchronous very well, which means that it now makes sense to add hardware drivers in there. Now, the Niagara 2 has a full crypto chip, and it does all the old SSL stuff that Niagara 1 did as well. It also has a async copy operation, and you can see where that kind of stuff is going to go. So that's an IoT-like feature. And what's really nice about the async copy is that normally every CPU thread in the Niagara chip they round robin through the core to get cycles, right? The copy is extra. It doesn't take up a CPU slot. It just happens in the background in the middle of the core. So it has a really interesting features. But the one thing about IOAT DMA is it doesn't work well for small transfers at all. Yeah, the overhead is huge. You have to talk to some device, or you have to submit something into the CPU, like the crypto chip. It's real expensive, so you have to have some kind of cutoff to do it, right? It's an interesting area. And the other thing is, back to net channels, that would be another way to kind of think about that kind of stuff, too. So I don't like RDMA, and I don't like it because it's a specialized protocol. I don't like specialized protocols. I would like generic TCP to have cache locality. With something like net channels, with a chip, right? If, for example, the S2IO guys had this huge flow table in their chips, and they can do all kinds of funny stuff like that. Once you start having all this RAM on the board and these huge flow caches and state tracking and stuff like that, well, could get interesting.
Well, one for all of you. What's the most embarrassing brown paper bag bug that you've introduced?
Oh, I definitely know which one this one is.
Thanks, Dave. That was an excellent question.
So a couple of days before leaving for Kernel Summit in Cambridge, we put this TCP fix into the input tree and then let us put out 2623 or whatever it was at the time, right before everyone flew out. And then I get to Cambridge, I start reading my email for a little bit, and all of a sudden, you know, just no more responses. It turns out I just totally nuked my mail machine back at home with that bug fix, which actually added a null pointer to reference to the TCP input path. So that was definitely, I ate my own dog food that time.
Last question, few. I do actually keep a brown paper bag on top of my desk to remind me that shit happens. Which would be the worst one? I don't actually remember. I know, like, recently we discovered a nasty, nasty bug somewhere in the power code. I don't remember exactly where it was. Probably around, you might remember, that I introduced in, I think, 261 or something like that. And it took all the way to 622 for it to start hitting somebody. And it was like really gross and dumb. It was something about mixing. Oh yeah, it was a single. I think it was a single stuff where I was basically trashing the floating point register in the signal recovery. If you happen to actually use floating point inside of your signal handler, and I think nobody noticed for like a long time, and it was pretty gross.
I work on the DRM, so we just have. Gross. It was just a big brown paper bag from when we introduced that code back about 8 years ago, and it just keeps going. It's always giving the DRM code.
I have so many to choose from, it's hard to pick one. I've made countless really stupid thinkos and silly things, like I've read the specs of some hardware wrong and got the endingness of a register wrong, where instead of bit zero, I'm actually banging bit seven of a register, or sometimes I pick the completely wrong register or even the wrong PCI device to be poking, all sorts of silly things like that I've done. It's hard to really pick one really nasty one when you've done so many small screw-ups.
You got one more? Just like that, a stupid bug in that. I remember I had one where I was hitting two registers, but I had the out be backwards because I'd been programming something in X Windows, and then I went to do it in the kernel, so my outs were the wrong way around. And just by pure accident, stuff worked until I fixed one bug somewhere else, fixed one of them, and didn't realize the other one was in a different part of the file. And then all of a sudden, things started breaking completely weirdly. I was like, but I just fixed the bug. How the hell did that happen?
I think it was probably one where I accidentally managed to kill the kernel on just about any machine with VIA Northbridge. But given that it's VIA, arguably this was an improvement.
I can actually top the lot of you. It was my fault that 2.6.8.1 came out. This was the first time we'd ever had a four-digit kernel, and I got a condition. I should have just go and look this up over there. I did if res, and I should have done if not res. Yeah. Sorry?
What was that code in?
NFS. So, you know, if I'd actually, you know, ever run the code that I'd patched, it...
That's why we have users.
Yeah, but Linus was my user. Okay, next question. And that was a good one. Can we have more questions like that one? No, there's incentive. We'll take a tulip back from you. Question.
So what does the panel think of the current release frequency?
Well, it ties in nicely with my distribution's release frequency, so great. Or the other, no, we were doing it first, I think.
Pretty much the same thing for Fedora. I mean, with Fedora being on a six-month release schedule, that means we can get several rebases to the latest release in one distro release cycle and always be shipping really shiny new code with shiny new features every single release.
I think we've got the speed right. Like, the timing is right. 3 months, 4 months is probably a pretty good... It's more the amount of crap we break that's probably wrong. So I think, yeah, the rate of change may be a bit too fast for the amount of time, but I think we're doing fairly well with it, and it's great to see new features actually get into the tree in a reasonable time.
One of the few downsides of having the ability to merge so much code and so many shiny new features is it's become really, really hard to review the patches that are going in just because there are so many of them. With thousands and thousands of diffs, there's no way a single person can read every single change that goes into the kernel anymore.
Well, yeah, actually the release frequency is tend to slow down, I don't know if you have noticed. It's getting more and more synchronized on which conference Linus is going to. Overall, when you're piecing code, it's actually quite nice to have a short target, and you know that whatever massive N3 write of the per PCPCI infrastructure, whatever the last thing I did, is going to get upstream soon. The main problem is that you spend a lot of time actually doing that, merge window happens, everything gets in, and you absolutely have zero time to look at what other people have been doing. In fact, it's in a way made worse by the best tool we had for a long time, which is Git. In the sense that since a lot of stuff goes through Git trees, whether it's a networking tree, whether it's Greg's tree with random all sort of stuff in it, etc. A lot of those things, unless you spend a lot of time reading 5 or 10 different mailing lists where those things go before they get into those secondary Git trees, basically just get in without you ever getting a chance to even notice. It's becoming pretty much impossible for a single person to follow what's going on. It's been for a while, actually, but it's getting even harder nowadays. Like, I personally feel that I'm completely dropping out of the loop in many, many, many areas, and I'm not alone. So yeah, sometimes you get up on like hash kernel and say, "Oh, it would be nice if we did something like that," and yeah, it's been merged yesterday. So yeah, it's nice, but it's something a bit scary as well.
I'd like to echo his sentiments. There is definitely the LCA release of the kernel, and then there's definitely the kernel summit release of the kernel every single year. We're definitely, the stars are in alignment as far as that's concerned. I think the timing is okay, but I definitely sense that people are getting better at merging a lot of stuff in the merge window and having it ready on time. I'm not talking about people who are trying to put stuff in after the fact. I'm talking about people who do have things ready. They do merge it on time. People are just getting faster at maintaining Git trees. And it, I mean, the fact that I can accumulate almost 1,500 patches ready for the merge window, that's out of control. I can't even follow that. I do remember looking at every single one of those patches, but I can't tell you all the details. It's just a human can't do it. But one of the things that I do try to do to kind of keep that under control is that I make sure that exactly what I merge to Linux is fully bisectable. And that means that you can build it every step of the way with your configuration 99% of the time. Because when the user hits the obscure thing and he tries to bisect and he can't build, that's basically a bug that's going to take forever to fix if it gets fixed at all. So we have to avoid that at all costs. And that's one way to manage the complexity, is to make sure that we can bisect any regression that we create into the tree. I mean, that's really important.
That's actually a very good point. Last week, I was trying to track down a scheduler regression that was reported in PowerPC, but we suspect it might actually happen every now and then on other things. And I found test case of something that ended up not actually being the regression, but whatever. I tried to bisect it. And more than half of my bisection point would either not build or not boot, because it was in the middle of the merge window. And that is something that we need to be more careful when I say us. It's not exactly me, because I'm not actually maintaining one of those staging trees that goes upstream, small pole. But that's something we should probably try to be more careful about. It's a bisectability of all those merge trees. And I mean, if something has to wait for the next version because nobody has the time or simple willpower of actually going through it, then it has to wait. But it's very important. And especially as the amount of stuff going in grows, it's getting harder and harder to try to find what could be the cause of a bug. Bisecting is sort of is a very, very, very important tool. I mean, it's something completely critical to identify regressions.
Absolutely, and there's another thing I wanted to touch upon about being overloaded. Like, if you're a subsystem tree maintainer like Greg, like me, Jeff Garzik, John Lindell, you're constantly applying patches to that tree, and you don't have much time to look to the side every once in a while. So even though I queue stuff up in my email box, for example, I'm interested in the per CPU patches and the slub bits and things like that that I know are going to affect me on Spark 64 and maybe performance-wise in the networking, and so I want to play with it at least a little bit on some of my machines and the trees that I'm maintaining, but they sit so long in the backlog of my mail that the guys post the next revision before I even get to test out the previous revision. So. And another point I want to make is you do not want to burn out the subsystem tree maintainers. You want them to still have at least a little bit of time to work on new stuff and in other areas, or else they're going to burn out. If you're doing networking stuff all the time, you're going to kill yourself. That's why I go and play with a useless arch like Spark 64 every once in a while, just to kind of clear my head of networking bits. It's an absolute requirement.
My rule of sanity is don't become maintainer of anything anymore.
Actually, I have a question for the audience. We mentioned Git bisect. I think most of the people in the crowd are users, consumers of the kernel rather than contributors. If you came across a bug and somebody asked you to run a Git bisect, and was, you know, and showed you like a man page or a URL that showed you, you know, how to run a Git bisect, would you be willing to do it? Are you aware of what it entails? Okay. Okay. Yes, I understand. Quite often, the response was quite often it doesn't build, and I accept that, and that is something that we all need to address. We've had pushback from some people saying it is totally inappropriate to ask a user who reports a bug to do a bisect.
There was a pretty nasty bug that showed up, at least one distance. there was a pretty nasty bug that I ran into in one distro. On the 2622.10 kernel, on some machines, they wouldn't shut down anymore. They wouldn't power down. And so one-liner that I had to build and build, and, you know, finally, it was the impossible. It was the stable patch that actually introduced this bug, and sent it up to Greg KH, and he said, that's crazy. And then, you know, I said, here, you know, comment out this line. That fixes it for you. It was some weird race. It still, I don't think, has worked out, but that particular bug was, you know, just simply backed out, I think, with the 2622.14 stable patch, and it just got reverted. But it was quite tedious to, in this particular case, because I had a bunch of patches, and I really tried every single one until I arrived at, it can't possibly be the stable patch. And then I took that apart into pieces, because it kind of came as a chunk, so I didn't really get to, I should have really gone straight to a git bisect, but it was pretty tedious to really get down to, you know, whatever ACPI, someplace, you know, line of code was that, I think it was, that broke that shutdown. And it turns out, I guess it's still open, because there's still a number of users that can't shut down on some machines, and on others it works, and it just seems to have to do with, you know, architecture.
One of the things, ACPI, as much as better as it has become, and God knows it's nowhere nearly near what it used to be, it still tends to come in big drops that will move backward in a couple of places, and...
I don't mean to ACPI.
Yeah, no, but you probably have a first-hand experience with the breakage.
Well, arguably, the real issue with ACPI is that it interacts with so many different parts of the kernel in so many ways that are not obvious. And a small change to the ACPI interpreter will have an influence on, say, interrupt routing. Sorry. And so the fact that within the ACPI tree, everything makes sense and looks fine and is great, we then merge that and it ends up conflicting horrifically with some minor change in the networking stack. And suddenly the universe ends, which is unfortunate.
Well, you have been able to import wireless and turn it off. I don't know if that's changed in the last... Well, there's a lot of machines nowadays that don't make much sense to run
the ACPI. Nowadays, if you're boosting a machine without ACPI, you're probably doing it wrong.
You can still pass ACPI equals off.
Yeah, and then your machine catches fire.
Especially with laptops.
The original question was, you know, if you were asked to run git with bisect, would you? I find when bug reporting, a big issue for me is just how important is the bug to me versus my time, because I come across a lot of bugs all up and down the stack, in the kernel, in the applications, and a lot of the time I can't be diagnosing every bug because it's just not that important to me versus my time. So a lot of the time I'll just file it away in the let's see if it gets fixed in the next version basket, and if it doesn't, maybe then I'll be willing to go in and dive deeper. And I suspect a lot of people are like that because, you know, I probably come across 10, 20 bugs a week, and that no way can I diagnose all of those. Impossible. So it's got to really matter to me personally that I really need that bug fixed. Otherwise it goes into the, hopefully somebody else will come across it and debug it.
I wonder whether it's still useful or not in that case to report it in the bug jar somewhere. Even if you know you're not going to be active, at least having it tracked somewhere and possibly having somebody else pick up, oh yeah, I've found that as well, and maybe somebody picking up. I know we have a lot of stale bugs in bug jars, but at the same time, it might still be better than having a totally untracked bug. I don't know, it's more a question I'm asking actually there.
Well, on that note, of all of you, do you use Kernel Bugzilla? If so, why? If not, why?
Usually, I do when I'm get CC'd by somebody. I'm not gonna go there and scrub. But you know, I don't maintain much things anymore. Like I do a lot of stuff, but I'm not the maintainer for them, except Radio Navy. But then I can't care about Radio Navy bugs anymore. So I'm not probably the best person to answer that.
Yeah. So I refuse to use it because I don't want to be clicking buttons all day. I'm more efficient at managing things in my mailbox. But the good thing is people like Adrian Bonk, Andrew Morton, they filter through this crap, and the things that are relevant they forward to the mailing list, and so it's right there in a format that's convenient for me, and we work out the bug on that thread, and it works pretty well. Another thing is that I wanted to touch upon, because the things Ben was talking about, is if you ever see me disappear for 2 days and I'm not applying networking patches, it's because while I was working on something, I hit one of those 10 to 15 bugs a week and I'm trying to fix it. I just can't. I know that if I move on, I'll never get back to that bug, just like I'll never get back to the per CPU patches that are sitting at the top of my email backlog queue that I want to play around with. So every bug is precious. You gotta dig through it and fix it, because it's kind of like it's how you earn the right to work on the new stuff, in my opinion.
Yeah, I know. I use most of my bugs end up in Free Desktop Bugzilla as opposed to the kernel Bugzilla, because people give out that X doesn't start if I break the kernel. But yeah, when things do arrive, I don't actually ever go into kernel Bugzilla unless I'm feeling really, really bored and want to have a look for something. But it's rare. But yeah. In terms of things, the way I worry, my problem is if a bug comes in on email, if I'm in the right mode, I look for it straight away. But if I'm not in that mode, if I'm doing something new or I'm working on some older stuff, I'll forget about it completely, and I won't ever go back to it. So
at SGI, we had a bug system called BugWorks, and all of the bug tracking was done via email. I mean, you just had a regular mail thread that had the history and everything in it, and that's, in my opinion, the way it ought to be. I hated the fact that I had to go to a web form that was broken half the time and wouldn't allow me to search reasonably. So, but Bugzilla 3 has addressed some of those shortcomings, so I don't know if that's going to be upgraded at some point.
So, 2 points. The first is the about me using Bugzilla and the like. I get swamped with the Fedora Bugzilla, and that's primarily takes up most of my time these days. So, but I still use the kernel.log Bugzilla as well. It's handy as a cross-reference sometimes. If I see something that isn't really making much sense in the Fedora Bugzilla, I can go search in the upstream Bugzilla and see if there's something similar, and maybe get some other data points. Or even just see if someone else is working on this problem already, or has even fixed it already. Going back to the Git bisect thing, something I want to say on that is, whilst it's a really amazing, fantastic tool, and it's found no end of bugs really, really easily for us, something that I've seen happening time and time again is I think we're becoming dependent upon it a little too much. Whereas a lot of developers now, they'll get a bug report, and the first thing they'll ask the user, can you go bisect this, rather than taking the information the user's already provided and trying to look at the code, trying to figure out exactly what is actually happening. So I think we should not rely on it quite as much, and it should be more of a last resort thing when we have got a damn clue what's going on, and sort of try to understand the problem a little better before we start, resorting to things like that.
Well, it doesn't depend also whether,
yeah.
A user has a single machine, for example, not doesn't have powerful machines at all, by sex it's kind of an unfair thing to ask.
Yeah, I mean, my request to user for bisect is essentially when it's a regression in something where, honestly, I'm looking at the report and the data and say, I have no bloody idea where to start, especially if it's something programming the file system. But now, if it's, most of the time, if it's in your area and you tend to have a look first and if you think there is something dodgy there and stuff. Yeah. I mean, we know, I mean, we ourselves, we try to avoid so bisecting with a pen neck.
I think it's just sort of bisect has replaced our old, oh, are you running the latest Git kernel? it's the excuse, because I don't know what's going on, so you go away for a while and maybe I'll think it'll come to me.
Right.
So if you file a bug on Bugzilla, you're really wasting everybody's time and resources at some level. But at the same time, there are other bugs that persist for longer. And it kind of really almost sort of opens up, or I've kind of wondered, you have the stable releases, but those are really secure.
and minimal major crashes. And you know, maybe, and obviously this is more work, obviously nobody's got time.
Actually, with the networking, every single bug fix I put into the current tree, we have a discussion, we evaluate whether it's appropriate for stable, and it's based upon not if it's a boom boom bug, but whether it's how many people get affected by this, and how bad would this screw them if we don't fix it. I've gone back all the way to 6.16. Yeah, like a release range or something could be a useful field, right?
Yes, because you don't really, you can't expect every release to backpoint every fix. Yeah, I have no way to do this. It might be helpful for some of the larger bugs anyways that aren't short-lived or just in between Git, you know, releases.
Right. Well, so I wanted to make a point about Git bisect. When you talk about this, realize that we have an economy of capability when we're dealing with this stuff. This means that people like me, people like Linus, people like the DRM expert over here, people like the PowerPC expert over here, we should be spending our times dealing with things once all the information is available. A user is a resource, and to the first order of approximation, when his bug is reported, it shouldn't get lost, the initial report. That's correct. But of the things that the user could do to help out, bisect is the most mechanical thing and requires the least amount of technical skills, and it can help us the most. And that's why it gets pushed out to the end nodes like that, that kind of work. And I think it's reasonable to a certain extent.
One tool that's not come up in this discussion so far, and I think this room really needs to be aware of it, is something that one of my colleagues at Intel wrote, which is called kernelops. If you go to kernelops.org, you can see broken down by different kernel releases, what the most reported bugs to Linux kernel are. It goes out, it's basically a subscription to Linux kernel, it filters through every single mail looking for oopses, it categorizes them, it tries to figure out where, what the responsible component is, and it can say, you know, the wireless subsystem is responsible for 22 of the 90 bugs that are, of the 90 oopses reported against 2.6.22. So it's a really useful tool, and I recommend Andrew's original point that he doesn't necessarily bother to report them unless he's got time to investigate them. It's really, really useful to kernel developers to know where the bugs that people are hitting are. You may only hit it once, but if everyone in the room hits it once, that's a bug we really need to be paying attention to, and it's and somebody will go look at it.
So one thing that I want to mention briefly is this: what we've been thinking about Git bisect as this is a hoop that a user must jump through in some way, and will potentially give us some useful information as a result. Possibly these guys, I'm not quite so good at remembering this, but I've only been really contributing code to the kernel for the past 2 or 3 years. And I still remember very strongly how intimidating it was to try to work out how I could usefully contribute to the kernel in the first place. And in some cases, a user with some programming ability but no real knowledge of how to get involved with the kernel, you can ask them to do a bisect. They'll identify the patch, and then potentially they'll be able to identify that bug, fix the bug, and not only have, by asking them to bisect, not only have you got them to work out where the bug is, you've also now got a patch that fixes the bug. And you've also got a new person who's contributing code to the kernel. But on the other hand, some people are probably put off by being asked to do a Git bisect, and we never hear from them again, which is a shame. But right, and sometimes people will be able to identify the file that is clearly responsible for this themselves, and then just by asking them to do this.
Right, so I want to comment on the tool. So you guys are relying on Git bisect a lot, and the Git bisect is actually a very, very good tool for developers. And I think it's unreasonable to ask users to go off and try and run that normal users, because I know I cannot put Linux in front of my family right now because of some of the issues around it. Even though they sort of use it for some things, there's still a lot of stuff missing that makes it really easy to debug issues that they run into. Just because collecting information is hard. Being able to have good tools to tear apart a core dump would be fantastic. Because then you can get all of the information in one chunk, and then you can run the tool across it to pick out whatever you care about in your subsystem, and then you can start looking at that stuff. Unix, HPX had a very good tool, and I believe Solaris does as well. Has very good debugging. Yes, I mean debuggers. So, debuggers is still for developers, though, right?
All right.
You can dissect a crash system when the cows come home, and not, and if the state's corrupted enough, you're not going to have any idea why it
That's
got
correct.
That way.
I agree with you, but if you get 10 dumps, you have a chance of getting one that will be right.
And about your family, they're not reporting bugs to the Linux kernel. They're not being asked to run git bisect. They have a nice support contract with pick your vendor of the week, you, right? Right? And you'll run bisect for us because you're the technically skilled person that interfaces with these people.
Exactly.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, and the other one is Bugginizer, or Bugzilla, sorry. So there's a lot of different Bugzillas out there. And my last problem was I happen to be Ubuntu, running Ubuntu on a particular laptop. I probably won't for very much longer, but yeah. We're in agreement, don't worry. But it actually turned out to be a problem with the actual firmware on the USB device, and we finally tracked it down and fixed it. I submitted a patch a week ago. However, that bug lived in Ubuntu's Bugzilla initially, because that's what I was using. That's why I thought it was a problem with their crap. You know, they had some version of HALD or something that was broken, or I didn't know what it was to start with. But the fact is, it lived there, and it's not talking to any other Bugginizer or Bugzilla version that we could share this information on. And I find it so as tulip maintainer, I'm looking at bugs in the bugzilla.kernel.org. I've got about 10 bugs there in my name, and I don't hear anything from other Bugzillas either, where they might have had problems with tulip driver. Right, so there's a communication issue between where bugs get reported and who actually gets to see them. Maybe you have some comment on that.
I work for IBM, and every now and then I do actually look into bugs concerning specifically the power architecture, and that's actually pretty true. A thing we usually do, one of the process for a newly found bug often is it's discovered somewhere, which can be one of the two main enterprise distro, or it could be just on upstream. Sometimes people actually do test upstream on those machines. We're probably, you go through some process looking for the bug, trying to identify it, fix it potentially, etc. But the necessary thing then is to reopen N copies of that bug mirror to all of the enterprise distros around to make sure they all actually have it. And one of the thing we don't have is we always work from our Bugzilla to the outside. We don't actually have a common feedback from the distro Bugzilla, which means that if distro X found a bug, doesn't go back to us, the other one still has it. And so typically that's been something we have to deal with internally, like at IBM. We keep constantly ping-ponging things to make sure that all of the distros actually get it. A couple?
Well, in principle, one of the design goals of the Launchpad products that Ubuntu used to track bugs, there's an advertising flyer for it in your bags. So I'm sure the rates are very reasonable. Was that it would be make it trivial to merge bugs from different cross-distribution bug tracking systems, regardless of whether they were based on Bugzilla, the Debian BTS, or arbitrary pieces of shell script. But since this is being recorded, I'm not going to say any more on the subject. But it's definitely, within the distributions, there is interest in being able to do this merging of bug information. It's not in anybody's interests, but the actually getting to the point where we can find some way of doing this without somebody then deciding that they are going to gain... without being able to gain some sort of competitive advantage from it, then I don't think anybody enjoys writing bug tracking systems. Well, I hear that Fermat's last theorem should be trivial to solve. Anyway, Bugzilla's user space.
So. Actually, the kernel loops thing that Willie mentioned, there's also a daemon side of that that will actually watch your kernel ring buffer and report them if you opt in to do so. So that kind of exists. The Bugzilla to Bugzilla talking thing, you mentioned that you heard about that at OLS, and I was actually talking about that 2 years ago at OLS. So, and pretty much nothing has happened since. Two Bugzillas can actually talk to each other. There's an XMLRPC protocol that they'll happily talk to each other. The big thing that's missing is the two Bugzillas have to have exactly the same database schema. Otherwise, madness ensues. So you need some kind of shim in the middle to translate, you know, one field into whatever the other end is expecting. And that's the key piece that's missing. Cool, and that's BTS link, BTS minus link. Cool, thanks.
So this pretty much means we're going to get those people that just jump on other people's bugs spammed across all the distros. That'd be really cool. There's me too, me plus one.
So it's wonderful that there's this tool and everyone should go check it out. And then there's the 5% left of the figuring out which bugs correspond to each other. And that is a lot of... it's the human side of the work, and that's what that's the resource issue, because it's pretty clear it's just a data mining problem. But within the distributions, people are already investing enormous amounts of time figuring out what bugs are the same bugs within their own systems, and to have this happen on a global scale as well, that's going to take some volunteer effort, I believe. And also, of course, as has been implied, it's a little bit politically charged as well. But the thing is, as we've seen with Kernel Bugzilla, there are people who are willing to be just, you know, turd cleaners and janitors walking through the tree and finding stuff that's not relevant anymore, poking the user. So we could probably get people to do this integration and analysis bits as well, as long as it didn't require past a certain threshold of skill and understanding in a subsystem.
New question.
Yeah. As usual. Don't we generate the same thing?
I'm curious about kernel debuggers. Do you guys think we should have one? And if we did have one, would the big vendors leave it enabled in the kernel?
There is a dirty little secret. Is that actually there is one in purpose architecture? Yeah, quite possible. Everywhere where Linux doesn't look too closely.
Sorry, on x86 or x86-64.
I don't know, what's the status of being able to hook KGDB on the body thing? That's actually...
What does Ingo think about it? Because now Ingo can just set this in without Linus noticing, right?
Well, I mean, so some of the thing Linus...
All right.
Hi, Linus. How are you doing?
Some of the things.
We were just talking about ice cream. Do you want some ice cream?
You've blown the plan, Willie.
Some of the stuff he's been saying against kernel debuggers still make a lot of sense. I mean, nobody really wants KDB in there. The main problem is once your kernel is screwed, often it's screwed in such a way that the kernel debugger itself will just make things worse. It depends. It depends basically how big your kernel debugger is and how far it tries to get through things. One other thing where with a little Xmon we have on purpose here, we try to keep it extremely simple, very low level, and with all sort of fault recovery mechanism in it. So it's mostly a tool to extract information out of a crash. We're not going to try to single step much through kernel code and things like that, because that's try to do that from a hardware interrupt handler and have fun. Question is, wouldn't it be better to just have some pipe through whatever, call it debugfs or anything else, and have user and tool that turn that into something displayable, like export the raw stuff through some pipe and. So we have net console for that, we can do something.
We have fireware debugging.
And Andrew swears by it, and on many occasions when he did have it working in the MM tree, or I don't know if it still does now, but he would hit some networking bug, he'd be like, okay, I'm in a GDB prompt, what variable do you need to look at right now? And he would keep his system running until I came along and said, oh yeah, look at this pointer, where is that pointer?
Yeah, we do that with Xmon.
Right, and another point is the resistance to a GDB in the kernel is the general resistance towards buggers. Similar opinion that people have towards the Git bisec as being a mindless response. We don't want people to have this mindless, okay, go into the debugger and try to figure it out instead of looking at the code and the crash stuff.
And just from the point of view of the non-remote servers or people with actual debugging, most of the problem we get in OOPS on a desktop, you ain't seeing it. You ain't ever going to see it. So that's even a bigger, it's like, there's no point even having a debugger. They can't even do anything. Like, these days, laptops, where are you going to get a serial port? We're now hopefully going to solve the graphics because we can see the OOPSes. I think we're going to get an awful lot more OOPSes because some laptops, you don't even know if the caps lock light is blinking. So, you know, it's like, is the caps light? What caps lock light?
I don't know if anyone's ever used soft ice on Windows, but we could do something like that with kernel mode setting. If you have a dual head system, one head is just your debugger, and the other head is your regular console.
In a different world, if somebody have used MaxBug on old Mac OS, similar kind of thing.
I mean, we're typically dealing with some kind of problem in, you know, an assert failure or something as we're looking at. We've got 8,500 lines of KDB module code for XFS for looking at tracing events that occurred, structures, and so on. And we basically can't find problems in XFS without it. Because it's so complex, you need to know exactly what happened leading up to the problem. We might have to go through several thousand events to work out the sequence of events of the race condition somewhere in the MM truncate code that led to the crash when we were closing the assert failure when we were closing the file. That's without a kernel debugger. You can't find that stuff because you've had a problem that is so far disconnected from the original race condition that it's effectively impossible. I
don't totally agree with you. Can't find that stuff, but
okay.
More than a debugger, what we need is a good data extraction tool and tracing tools, which expose one big problem is how do we get the data out of the machine that has a problem? And we get into completely different categories. Basically, one is the machine that is still running and up, and there are ways to go through layers or stacks of things, of protocols, and or not. And as we mentioned before, I mean, we not even don't have serial ports anymore. FireWire is behind the IOMMU most of the time. You can't actually pick at your internal memory anymore in 32-bit anyway. USB, you got to run 3-layer stack to get anything through USB, and it's going DMA all over the place. It's actually a hard. The problem is not at data. The problem is really, I think, need to be tried to be solved at the low level. Is how do you actually get a data transport mechanism that can be used in like crash circumstances and situations to get the data out? And then once you have that, on top of that, we could look into making some kind of kernel trace, or maybe really some of the infrastructure we have for traces in the kernel and or markers and things like that, and make it remotely controllable through that path. NetPol is actually not necessarily a bad way to go there. There's some nasty looking issues with it, but it's not necessarily a bad way to go there. It's pretty universal at least. Yeah, we have Kdon kind of thing as well.
It's 22. Donna just came around and said that really they are closing this building at 6. There's an event for the speaker's dinner is at 6, and some people need to get back to their lodgings, drop off laptops and whatnot, and then come back. Speakers are to meet at the registration desk at 6. So I'd like to thank our panel. And I'd like to thank you all for coming.